This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harrell.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I'm Jim Harrell. Happy Halloween. I'm so excited to be with you, and it is that spooky time of year, and that's why I'm really excited. We're going to have a couple of great guests. We're doing continuing our month of double feature paranormal podcasts. If you're new, welcome. I hope that you enjoy the program. First up is going to be Nick Redfern. He's going to talk about the world's weirdest places. And then we're going to have John Kachuba talking about his latest spooky book. And that'll be in part two. I hope that you enjoy the Paranormal Podcast. Yes, our guest today is Nick Redfern. Now, if you've listened to this program at all or followed any of the paranormal community the last 10 years, you know who Nick Redfern is, and he's here to talk about his latest book, The World's Weirdest Places. Now, a little bit about Nick. He's an author, lecturer, and journalist who writes about unsolved mysteries. His previous books include The Pyramids and the Pentagon, Keep Out, The Real Men in Black, The NASA Conspiracies, Contactees, and Memoirs of a Monster Hunter. He writes for UFO Magazine, Fate, and Fortean Times, and has appeared on the History Channel's Ancient Aliens, Monster Quest, UFO Hunters, and many other television programs. He can be contacted at nickredfernsbooks.blogspot.com. We're so glad to have him on the show. It's always a pleasure. Nick, welcome back to the Paranormal Podcast today.
Well, thanks, Jim. How's it going?
It's going well, and the perfect time of year to talk about this book, The World's Weirdest Places. I'm guessing it wasn't a coincidence it came in out around Halloween.
Now, I think the publisher tried to figure it out around about that period when everything kind of starts to get spooky, I guess.
Yeah, and certainly this book is spooky. Now, you talk about a ton of places here that are they're spooky. I think it's something like 25 chapters of different spooky places. Now, you not only are you writing about this, this is not like this is your first rodeo. You've personally been around a lot of weird places. Do you really think some places are inherently weirder than others?
Yeah, I actually do. I mean, that was the whole sort of thrust of the book. You know, it's kind of like that you can find weird stuff anywhere, you know, but very often it's just sort of at random where somebody sees Bigfoot in the woods near one particular town, and that, you know, that's the only thing that happens. But there are certain areas that seem to be all around the world that seem to be kind of like hotspots or magnets for paranormal and strange phenomena. I guess the most famous one is one that I didn't include in the book because it's been done so many times, and that's Point Pleasant, West Virginia, you know, where the Mothman was seen in the 60s, because you had Mothman, you had UFO encounters, the Men in Black, then you had the collapse of this bridge which killed all the people and the cars fell into the Ohio River. So, you know, it's like there are certain places where they're just saturated in strange stuff constantly. And so what I did was to sort of, the publisher said, well, you know, on 25 places, pick what are your, you know, which ones ever are your favorites, and sort of do a chapter on the ones where you felt, you know, they were like a portal or a doorway to, you know, just allow however much weird stuff through. And that's kind of the thrust of the book, is looking not just at the places, but the theories that explain why these sort of portals or these paranormal hotspots might exist.
Well, I do want to talk a little bit about some of your favorite places out of the 25. Obviously, we're not going to have time to cover them all. That's why people should check out the book. But what kind of explanations do you think there are for certain places being weirder than others? Is it ley lines? Is it some kind of magnetic field? All of the above? What are some of the explanations for some places literally being weirder than others?
Well, most of them, actually, Jim, kind of seem to fall into one particular category, even though it's sort of been referenced in different ways and forms over the years. And that's to say, you know, we're looking at something probably, I think at least, where we're dealing with interdimensional entities. I mean, things like quantum physics today are allowing for the existence of like multi-dimensions or extra dimensions that kind of coexist alongside ours, but you can only be, like a car radio, you can only be tuned in to one at any given time, even though they're all sort of running in tandem with each other. As I said, quantum physics is allowing for these dimensions, and the theory is that if you know how to do it, you could hop from one dimension to another if you understood, you know, the specifics of how it works. And I actually think that some of these places around the world are sort of natural portals or doorways to other realms. One of the theories is that, you know, if you understood the technology or how it works, you could jump into dimensionally at will. But there could be also natural states and places where these portals and doorways are always sort of opening and closing, but they remain static in one area. So that might explain, for example, you know, some of these baffling cases where somebody sees like an 8-foot-tall, 400-pound Bigfoot in a town very close to civilization, but then it's not seen again, you know, for another 3 years or whatever, because potentially, you know, it's sort of hopping from one realm to the other. And that might also explain why we see UFOs and other strange creatures in the same areas and sometimes at the same time as Bigfoot. I don't actually take the view, as some people do, that Bigfoot is connected to UFOs in the sense that, you know, Bigfoot comes from a UFO. I don't believe that. But what I do believe is that possibly there are a whole range of different interdimensional entities that use these portals to get through to our world. So it may be, you know, we perceive them all being connected because they're in the same place, but it might be the equivalent. They're all getting off at the same subway station, if you see what I mean.
Right.
But they're not necessarily directly connected with each other, possibly.
Now, I know that you've done a lot of field investigation and been a lot of places, a lot of weird places. Mm. Have you kind of developed a spooky radar? You know, do you go on site and you say there's something unusual about this place? Is that something you ever feel?
Yeah, oh yeah, I do. I mean, so people would understand, there's 25 places in the book, and I think of those 25, I've been to 16, and the other 9 that I haven't been to, I specifically chose them because friends and colleagues had been there, and so they were able to share with me their information and their thoughts. So in other words, either me or a close colleague and friend has traveled to all the places. And one of the things I've found, certainly, you know, in going to certain areas that have this sort of weird phenomena or legend attached to them, is that you do get this feeling of weirdness, but it's like a hard-to-define weirdness. You know there's something not quite right about the town. You know, it's kind of like walking into Twin Peaks or something like that, you know, where you kind of get this feeling
without the donuts.
No. Without the donuts and the coffee, or maybe with the donuts and the coffee, I don't know. But, you know, you kind of get this feeling that there's like an undercurrent of strangeness there, but it's difficult to put your finger on. But when you realize, you know, it's attached with all this strange stuff as well, then you do get this feeling. It's not necessarily you get it because you see something weird flying around or lumbering around in the woods. It's just, you know, kind of that feeling people often get when they're in a situation or a location that's sort of strange or odd. They get a feeling, kind of like when you get a feeling for a person. I mean, I'm sure, although a lot of people probably won't admit it, you know, occasionally meet someone and you just get this really unsettling vibe from them,
right?
You know what I mean? But you don't
right.
know why. You've never met them before. They've not done anything to you, but you just get this feeling that they're probably not a good person to be around. And I think it's kind of like that. It's like you sense something, but you're not really sure why you're sensing it.
We are going to get to in a little bit some of the specific cases, but what were the criteria that you used to select, because there are thousands of weird places around the world?
Yeah.
Why these 25?
Well, I mean, in fairness, I could have, you know, chosen, I could have made it the world's 50th, you know, 50 top weird places.
It's sequel but, opportunity.
I mean, exactly. But the sort of criteria I looked for was where it was like a clearly delineated place, like a specific mountain or a valley or a forest or a town, you know, where it had borders, where, in other words, it wasn't just me saying, you know, I was picking a country that's hundreds and hundreds of miles long, you know, where you would find a lot of different weirdness. You know, these were areas maybe, in some cases, you know, like a mile or two wide and, you know, a mile or two long, or 15 miles by 6 miles, you know, they were clearly delineated small places, yet they were saturated with strangeness. So that was one of the criteria. Another one was that, you know, for the most part, instead of them just being, you know, say Bigfoot seen there, but if you had Bigfoot, you had werewolves, you had a lake monster story, you had a famous UFO encounter, there were numerous haunted houses in town, and they're all, you know, in this one area. That was the other main criteria, that it wasn't just one weird thing that's seen time and time again, but you actually had sort of five or six different, seemingly unattached paranormal things all going on, all in the same area, and very often at the same time as well.
Well, after we get back from this break, I want to talk to Nick about some of the world's weirdest places, some of his favorites, and we'll do that right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. Well, if you like what you hear on our free Paranormal Podcasts, we have, of course, the free 90-day archive for Paranormal Podcast and Campfire over at jimherold.com. Absolutely free. I mention that because I know we have some new people this week. Apple was kind enough to feature us on their front page. But I do want to say, if you really see that you're enjoying these programs, or maybe for those of you who have listened for a while, and you want more than a 90-day archive, you want to go back to shows we did all the way back to 2005, and also access a bunch of exclusive paid podcasts I do, check out jimherold.net. That's where my Paranormal Plus Club lives. Now, of course, we have the free content, the last 90 days, over at jimherold.com. But over at jimherold.net, there are over 500 podcasts that you can check out. My Campfire show, which is True Ghost Stories, you can check out this show. Plus, I do a show called The Other Side. I do another show called The Crime Scene, another one called Conspiracy Corner, and UFO Encounters. And that's just for starters, what you get over at the Plus Club. You also end up getting access to a paid newsletter that I send out regularly that you don't get if you're not a member. You get access to webinars with me, meet and greets. You get paranormal courses and so much more. And there's a very economical monthly plan if you want to check it out and sample it and see what you think. If you're convinced and you say, hey, I want to go the full year in, it is a great time because we have a Halloween special going. You get the yearly membership, but already you get 12 months for the price of 10. On top of that, if you sign up for the yearly, this is the yearly only, you get your choice of a free Kindle book, either my Campfire book or Annie Wilder's Trucker Ghost Stories book, either one. And this offer, this specific offer for the bonus book, is good only through Halloween, October 31st. So jump on it now. Go over to jimherold.net and check it out for all of the content. You know, if you like what you've sampled, the free 90 days, now's the best time to do it. Check it out over at jimherold.net, and I appreciate your support. Our guest is Nick Redfern. The book is The World's Weirdest Places, a perfect selection for this Halloween time of year. Nick, I'm just going to start with your first weird place that you talk about. And this one holds a special place in my heart because I'm in my early 40s. And when I was but a wee lad in the 70s, I remember some books by Charles Berlitz. And I think this was almost the first supernatural thing I got really interested in. Don't know why. But I was probably a little kid of 5 or 6 years old, so it tells you what kind of kid I was. But anyway, Bermuda Triangle, you don't hear as much about it these days, but my goodness, a lot of very tangible and very spooky stuff happening there. Why did you decide to start the book with that and tell us a little bit about the Bermuda Triangle?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're quite right that we don't hear that much about it today, but it is an area that's been covered, you know, extensively in the past, but kind of the opposite to why I didn't include anything on Point Pleasant, West Virginia, with Mothman, was because that's still very much an ongoing thing, and there are books coming out all the time on Mothman. So that was the reason I omitted that from the book. But with the Bermuda Triangle, it was certainly something that was massive in the 70s, but today it's become very much like under the radar, so to speak.
Right.
So I figured, why not bring that one to a new audience, and more importantly, with new cases as well, you know, that have occurred since the sort of the Berlitz era, the mid to late 70s and whatever, you know, when there was this huge craze for it. The reason I include, a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, people get lost and disoriented in the oceans if they're not, you know, used to it, which is actually true. You know, you have to be very careful on big oceans and, you know, that you don't become confused and you read your compasses right, et cetera, et cetera. But in saying that, there still seems to be more of like a preponderance of enigmatic weird reports in this area. And I talk about a number of cases from the 90s with aircraft, you know, that experienced sort of weird aviation-based problems in the sky, you know, and compasses going wild and all sorts of strange stuff. So it's very much an ongoing thing. And, of course, you know, I think the most famous case, this one of Flight 19, a U.S. Navy basically like a group of Avenger aircraft went missing after taking off from Florida in areas of the sky that they knew very well. You know, this is the interesting thing, that this case involved, you know, five Avenger aircraft with crews, flying across the ocean from Florida. So basically they went east, you know, you leave the east coast of America, so you fly east, you know. And they got lost. They reported back to base that the ocean didn't look like it should, and they couldn't identify the small islands they could see. Now, what's very weird about this is, you know, they reported all this stuff where things didn't look like they should, which we were never able to get clarification on that because, you know, they didn't explain it. But that's sort of a very weird statement to make, you know, that the things just didn't look like it should look like. But the weirdest thing of all, and this sort of comes and ties in with like the disorientation angle, is that if you're flying east, you know, away from America and you're lost, well, all you've got to do is look at your compass and fly west, because eventually then you'll just come back to, you know, Florida. It's the easiest thing in the world, but they didn't think to do that. Nobody thought, well, let's just, you know, look at the compasses. Instead of going east further out to the Atlantic, let's just go west and back to the land. And yet that they didn't do that. They just went straight around in circles. And there is evidence, you know, that they changed the direction three or four times, which is fatal, you know, because you start to run out of fuel. Now, some people have said, well, maybe they ditched in the ocean. But there was never any wreckage found, no bodies. Even today, you know, the aircraft haven't been found on the bottom of the ocean. There were no oil slicks or fuel, you know, fuel leaks on the ocean surface, nothing. They were just gone. Even one of the search planes that was sent up to find them, that vanished right afterwards as well. No sign of that one either. So, you know, you have the five original planes and the search plane. And for me, this case for the Bermuda Triangle, you know, is like Rendlesham Forest for ufology. You know, it's like the defining case that there was something weird going on there.
Well, the thing that fascinates me, and I, you know, I'm pretty familiar with the lore. Odd things you retain from your childhood. I remember Flight 19 and a lot of the other cases. But as you said here, you're talking about some cases in the 90s and as late as 2008, I think, you know, that we hadn't heard about, or most of us hadn't at least.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that again, you know, I was like, if I'm going to do something where, you know, the publisher wanted some classic old places, I said, well, that's fine, but if I'm going to do that, you know, you don't want to just go over old ground. So I actually managed to find, as you said, you know, one from the 2000s, a number from the 1990s. And what was interesting, you know, these were airliners. You know, they were qualified civil airline pilots, very adept, you know, not sort of somebody just taking off in a small Cessna plane or whatever, you know, on their first flight or whatever, you know, having lessons. These are airline pilots who reported these issues. And that was one of the main reasons I wanted to include the Bermuda Triangle chapter, because I think a lot of people, whether they believe in the phenomena or not, very much assume that these cases, you know, were all of the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. But what's actually happened is they're still going on, but the mystery doesn't have sort of the interest that it did have back then. So a lot of these cases don't get highlighted unless you sort of specifically go looking for them.
Now, one thing I like about this book is that you take us kind of on a, when you say world's weirdest places, you really mean the world. It's not just stuff in the U.S. and North America and England, but you go all over the world. And I'd like to talk a little bit about Sydney, Australia, because not only is it fascinating, and I don't know the lore there, but also we have a lot of Australians that listen to our program. So as a doff of the cap to them, we want to talk a little bit about Sydney, Australia. What did you find about this land down under?
Well, yeah, I mean, Sydney, you know, is fascinating. I mean, it's a beautiful city, but it's a fascinating place as well, because within Sydney and its surroundings, again, there's a lot of very, very strange stuff. I mean, you know, you get out of the city itself and into the adjacent forests, etc., and you have a lot of reports of the Australian equivalent of Bigfoot, which is known as the Yowie, Y-O-W-I-E. And the Yowie, you know, a lot of countries around the world have, you know, legends of sort of hairy, man-like creatures. Most famous ones, probably Bigfoot and the Abominable Snowman of the Himalayas. But then China has the Yeren, Caucasus Mountains in Russia has the Almasty, and as I said, Australia has the Yeren. But there are a number of interesting reports about the Yowie that place it in somewhat of like a paranormal category. You know, the reports of these creatures vanishing in the blink of an eye. And they seem to have this sort of magical, paranormal element to them, you know, rather than just being an unidentified ape-like creature. So that's one of the things I focused on with regard to Sydney. But there was also, you know, there are reports of large black cats roaming around the area, which should not exist, you know, in Australia, and certainly not in the suburbs of Sydney. Also, there was a very, very weird report from the 1960s where a woman driving home saw this extremely strange creature come out of a lagoon. It was kind of described as, you know, like a two-legged animal, sort of the size of a chimpanzee, but it had sort of the head and snout of like an anteater, almost like a long trunk. And its front limbs, if you like, paws, whatever they were sort of held up, hanging, you know, kind of if you have a pet dog and you stand him on his hind legs, you know, and the front paws kind of just dangle. It was like that. And, of course, there's nothing in the zoological record, you know, that looks like that at all. And yet people, this woman reported it and stood by her story, you know, for her entire life. So a lot of weird animal things going on in Sydney, but there's also a place called Quarantine Station, which is now a famous restaurant. But more than a century ago, actually longer than that, it was a place where many people who had very serious infectious diseases were basically held there, you know, to prevent these diseases spreading all across Australia and becoming, you know, massive outbreaks. And what's intriguing is that, you know, a lot of these people died, unfortunately, in very agonizing circumstances. And in the old quarantine station, as I said, which still exists today, there are a lot of reports, you know, of people hearing strange moans and groans, and a lot of ghost hunting groups go there and have reported a massive amount of strange activity, particularly in the areas where the people were held, you know, when they were just dying in their hundreds, you know, from these killer diseases, etc. Sure. So, you know, it's like a residual something has remained behind. You know, so those are, you know, those are some of the more significant things, the Bigfoot type reports, the big cats, this strange creature in the 60s, and a lot of ghostly activity around Sydney as well.
Well, when you think about strange and weird things, certainly the New York subway is a place mm-hmm. where you might see some rather strange things, but usually supernatural isn't a part of that weirdness. You found that there were some very strange things, and all joking aside, made themselves known on the New York subway or in the New York subway. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure everybody, you know, knows these legends and stories about alligators in the New York sewers, you know, and so there are a lot of people think it's all folklore, but there were one or two verified cases from the 40s where alligators had been dumped in the sewers. You know, it was people who got exotic pets and they got too big to handle. They didn't want to have them killed or put to sleep or whatever, so they, you know, they dumped them down the toilet or whatever, you know, and they did start to grow. So one or two of these stories can be verified, but, you know, the New York subway system, because it's deep underground, anywhere deep underground can be prone to flooding. And so beneath the subway itself, there are a lot of sort of sewer systems and, you know, anti-flooding places in place, you know, to deal with some sort of calamity along those lines. And there are a number of stories about people, workers, for example, you know, deep below the New York subway system in some of the old sewers that exist there, seeing like 5 to 8 foot long, you know, pretty savage alligators, you know, and the theories are they live on whatever they can find, you know, rats, feral cats, you know, hobos, who knows what. Now, so I included, a few stories like that in the book, which I don't rule them out because, as I said, one or two of these stories from New York have been verified. So it's not a stretch, you know, that they could have sort of made their way into the sewers beneath the subway system. But there was another very weird story, again, of a strange animal that the best way I can describe it is like, rather than Bigfoot, is like Littlefoot, where this is where I actually interviewed the witness. He worked at one of the hotels that surrounds Central Park at the time, and he said, you know, I saw this strange creature, which he could only describe it. It wasn't like a little rhesus monkey or anything like that. It was almost like a perfectly formed humanoid, but covered in hair, but only like about 2 to 3 feet tall. And he actually, this is where it gets weird, he saw it on a couple of occasions, and yet it seemed that nobody else in the vicinity of the subway exit where he saw it bounding out from towards the park seemed to see it. And the fact that he saw it twice and he said it caught his eye, or vice versa, he felt that, you know, maybe there was something paranormal to it, in the sense that, again, it was something that was sort of dimension hopping, and that for whatever reason he was able to see it but other people weren't. Granted, he was only 3 feet tall, but I mean, if you saw a 3 foot tall monkey bounding across, you know, from the subway exit to Central Park, you know, considering how busy New York is, at least you would think a couple of dozen people would see it, but nobody seemed to be bothered or notice it at all. And he felt that it was real in some sense, but also paranormal. And, you know, he wasn't a crazy guy. As I said, he worked at one of the local hotels that overlooks the park and just wanted answers. And, you know, we had a sort of good chat about it. But again, it's sort of one of those hard to define things, but I think it fits into that sort of portal category, because it was like a lot of these things. It was here 1 second and then gone the next.
And if we take our tour over to Russia, you did a chapter on the Kremlin in Moscow. Mm. And I find that interesting because of all the mystique, particularly being a kid of the Cold War era. The mystique of the Kremlin is strange enough, let alone maybe some supernatural twists.
Yeah, I mean, the Kremlin is a very old building. You know, it's basically the Russian equivalent of, like, the White House. You know, it's where Vladimir Putin, the current Russian premier, operates from. And the origins of it go back, I mean, literally like 800-900 years. I mean, you know, it's not exactly the same building as it was then, obviously, but the foundations, you know, the old building that was there is what the Kremlin is built upon. But the Kremlin is sort of noted for two paranormal issues in general. One, it has a crashed UFO legend attached to it, not unlike Roswell. There's a long-standing story about how in the summer of 1947, reportedly workers in the city of Kiev, who were digging underground to build some underground structures, came across this large cylinder-like object made of metal. But first thought was, you know, was it some German device that had come down in the Second World War, and that because of all the carnage of the war going on, you know, it was some sort of bomb that failed to explode or whatever, you know, like a missile or whatever. So it was carefully dug up and, you know, handled very carefully. But the story is that when scientists were brought in to analyze it, they kind of got the feeling from studying the marks on it, etc., that it was very, very ancient, possibly thousands of years old. And then, of course, you know, that places things in a whole different category. So the object was reportedly taken to a bunker deep below the Kremlin. Now, that part of the story we can verify, particularly at the height of the Cold War, like most nations around the world, you know, when the realization of what, you know, the specific power of the atomic bomb, you know, could flatten cities, sure, a lot of nations have built underground bunkers. You know, there's one beneath the White House. They have them beneath London, you know, for the government, etc. Unfortunately, not for us poor souls who live above. You know?
we're on our own.
Yeah, exactly. It'll basically be every man for himself, you know. But a lot of these sort of government departments, offices, that they have these deep bunkers. So it would make sense in Russia to take it to, you know, one of these places below the Kremlin, which we know they go down like several hundred feet, and they're sort of hardened concrete bunkers, etc. Now, the story is that the object was held there for a number of years before then being taken further onto sort of one of the Russian space facilities, you know, where they did all their rocket research. But it's a story that still persists, and it's sort of like a definitive Russian Roswell. But the other thing that's going on at the Kremlin is that there have been a number of sightings of the ghosts, if you like, of former Russian leaders, most prominently Joseph Stalin and Lenin. And the story of Lenin's is interesting because his spirit, if you like, or soul or ghost, whatever you want to call it, was actually seen before he died. When he was on his deathbed, he was actually based, he had another sort of home place, if you like, but he worked at the Kremlin. And when he was lying deathly ill on his deathbed, his soul, if you like, was seen kind of gliding through the corridors of the Kremlin. And of course, a security guard quickly phoned his own residence and said, Lenin's own residence, and said, I thought, you know, Lenin was near death in bed. And the doctor said, well, he is. I'm looking at him. You know, he's unconscious. And the guard said, well, we've just seen him sort of walking, striding, if you like, in what looks like really good health through the corridors of the Kremlin. And when they spoke with one of the guard said how Lenin just seemed to vanish, you know, just fade away. So the theory is that, you know, maybe as he was sort of nearing death, his soul, if you like, wanted to see the office he loved, you know, one last time. And so that's the story of Lenin. There's also a story of the ghost of Joseph Stalin having been seen there, and that reportedly that ties in with when the temperature, you know, sort of drops, I mean, plummets literally, you know, in certain pockets around the Kremlin, and then Stalin's form kind of materializes, you know. So there's a lot of strange stuff like that.
Well, I want to ask you about one more before we get to maybe one of your favorites. Maybe we've talked about your favorite yet. I don't know. But you mentioned it earlier, and any discussion of UFOs is really incomplete without talking about Rendlesham Forest. What are your thoughts on it, and what did you talk about in the book in regard to it?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're right, Jim. You know, when anybody talks about you know, Rendlesham Forest, the first thing they think of is the famous UFO landing of December 1980, you know, when numerous military personnel saw, over the course of 3 nights, multiple UFOs, strange lights in the sky, weird creatures in the woods, and, you know, reports from military personnel of a massive clampdown by British and American authorities. But that would be weird enough in itself if it wasn't for the fact that Rendlesham Forest is like a hotbed of high strangers, and has been not for just for decades, like with Rendlesham, the UFO story, but literally for hundreds of years. For example, going back 400 or 500 years, literally, in that area, there's a story of a creature known as the Shug Monkey, S-H-U-G. And Shug is basically an old English distortion of a word meaning skooker, which means demon. So the Shug Monkey basically means demon monkey. And it's described as this sort of glowing-eyed, five-foot-tall, kind of like a large chimpanzee-like animal that roams the woods, of all places, you know, where the UFO is seen. There have been a lot of reports of large black cats, not unlike the ones in Sydney, Australia, roaming the woods again. And also, you know, there should not be any wild, huge black cats, you know, on the loose in Britain, but people report them all the time, and a sizable number of reports from Rendlesham. Also sightings of large black dogs with these fiery red eyes, not unlike, you know, the story from The Hound of the Baskervilles by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who actually based his novel on these existing legends of these ghostly, fiery-eyed black dogs in Britain. And there's also a ghost story about a Second World War German pilot who reportedly crashed his plane on the edge of the woods, got killed, and, you know, his ghost roams around the old airfield, etc. And on top of that, what's kind of really ironic is that skeptics of the idea that a UFO landed at Rendlesham say that, oh, it was just a light from a nearby lighthouse. The lighthouse they're talking about is situated just a couple of miles away at a place called Orford Ness. And about 900 years ago at Orford Ness, sort of a wild man-type creature was seen, and it's a very famous story recorded in an old manuscript where this hair-covered creature was caught in the area, and he was sort of semi-tamed and lived in Orford Castle for a while before deciding to head off back to the woods, if you like. So, you know, that's what makes Rendlesham really weird, is that you've got the famous UFO case, but you've got big cats, black dogs, the Shug Monkey, a ghostly pilot, and then this wild man type character just down the road at Orford, which the skeptics say was responsible for the UFO encounter.
Well, it's been a fascinating tour of many weird places. Maybe if we could wind up, and I'm mm-hmm. sure we talked about some of your favorites, but give us a favorite that maybe we've not talked about, and why you find it so appealing.
Yeah. Well, for me at least, I would have to say Loch Ness, Scotland, because like Rendlesham, you know, you think of one thing whenever anybody mentions Loch Ness, and that's, of course, the Loch Ness Monster.
Sure.
Again, but Loch Ness, like all these other places, is a hotbed for strangeness. For example, in the early 20th century, the famous occultist Aleister Crowley had a house on the shores of Loch Ness called Beleskin House, which is still there. And he tried to conjure up demons from the loch in the 1910s. Then, of course, you had the Loch Ness Monster turn up. And the house was later owned by Jimmy Page, the guitarist with Led Zeppelin. And he said even in the 70s, you know, they had this weird atmosphere to it in this old house. But there's also a story of, well, it's actually verified that a British Royal Air Force plane crashed in the Loch in the 1940s. And there's a story about how one of the only crew member who didn't survive the crash, that his ghost haunts the Loch. There have been UFO encounters over the Loch. In 1974, 1973, a famous Loch Ness monster hunter named Ted Holliday actually had an encounter with a man in black on the shores of Loch Ness. And again, there have been these large black cats roaming around the area too. So, you know, Loch Ness is home to far more weirdness than just Nessie. And, you know, it's sort of, a definitive weird location.
Well, Nick, it is a fascinating tour of the world's weirdest places. We certainly appreciate you coming on the show. Where can people find out more about everything that you do, and where can they pick up on the book at?
Sure. Well, the book's called The World's Weirdest Places, published by New Page. You can get it, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any good online or, you know, bookstores as well. People can contact me at nickredfern14, fortean.blogspot.com, or type me into Facebook and, you know, reach me that way as well.
And what else is going on in the world of Nick Redfern? What else are you working on these days? Because I know you've got a lot going on. I see a lot of posts.
I'm working on a couple of cryptozoology books right now, and one for later this year and one for in the summer. The one that's coming out in probably about a month or so, that'll be all by sort of road trip investigations of things like Bigfoot and lake monsters that I've done over the last 3 years. And then the one next summer is called The Monster Files, and it's all about what government agencies know about strange creatures, so like government files on Bigfoot and sea serpents and things like that.
That sounds like a good one. Both of them sound like good ones. Nick Redfern, thank you so much for joining us today on the Paranormal Podcast. It is always a pleasure.
Thanks, Jim.
As always, I enjoyed that conversation with Nick. He always has such interesting viewpoints and books that he writes. We really enjoyed it. And now on to another one of my favorite guests about his latest book, this time fiction, but very, very spooky, John Kochuba on the Paranormal Podcast. Today we have a great guest, a return guest. He's been on the program a couple of times. One of my favorite people in the paranormal world, truly one of the nice guys, and a very talented writer as well. I'm talking about John Kochuba. He is the author of 7 books, including 4 about ghosts and ghost hunting. He's a member of the Historical Novel Society, a writing instructor at 2 universities, and a certified ghost hunter. His latest book is a little bit of a departure for him. It's a fictional book. It's called Dark Entry, and it's shooting up the charts on the Kindle charts, ebook charts. So it's exciting, and we can't wait to talk to him about it. John Kochuba, welcome back to the Paranormal Podcast.
Thanks, Jim. It is great to be back again. I appreciate it.
So you've done a lot of the ghost hunting books and so forth, and those have been great. We share our home base state of Ohio. Why did you decide to take things in the fictional side at this point?
Well, you know, I've always been interested in fiction. And as a writer, you know, all my life I've been writing both nonfiction and fiction. And it just seems to me that nonfiction books, which were my 4 ghost hunting books, the Ghost Hunting Ohio series and Ghost Hunting Illinois, and Ghost Hunters from New Page, by the way, your publisher, you know, those books have a definite audience, and there are people that like to read them, and they're about real places that you can go to and investigate and all that. But I also realize that there's a lot of people who aren't necessarily interested, let's say, in going to visit a haunted location. They're not necessarily ghost hunters. They may not even watch the TV programs like, you know, Taps and all the other ones.
Sure.
Out there. But they might be interested in ghost stories. You know, ghost stories have been with us for millennia. You know, I mean, every culture around the world has ghost stories, and they go back thousands and thousands of years, and we're still telling ghost stories. So there's a universal interest in ghost stories, and it's more than just universal interest in, let's say, being scared. It's, I think, looking at some of the larger questions about what ghosts are, what that means for us. And so I thought that going through fiction approaching the whole sort of ghost and metaphysical concepts of ghosts through fiction would be a way to reach maybe a whole new audience that I might not be reaching right now with the nonfiction books. And I'm assuming that my nonfiction readers, the ghost hunters, you know, will probably read the fiction as well. But I think I'm tapping into a much broader audience that just has an interest in ghost stories. And what they're going to find out is that in my ghost stories, you know, they're going to get my philosophy as well, but it's going to be, you know, it'll be hidden in fiction. But they will get my views on the paranormal, on what ghosts are and what they do and you know, how they do what they do and whatever. But it'll be, you know, couched in the guise of a story. So I think it's a good approach. And I just love doing fiction anyway. I read tons of fiction and I write fiction. So it's natural for me.
Now, that's an interesting perspective, the idea of kind of getting across your philosophy on the paranormal in your fiction. So let me ask you this. Obviously, there are some incredible true ghost stories out there. However, in fiction, probably can take a little bit further, go a little bit more expansive, suspension of disbelief and all of that. How do you judge how far to go with that? Because you still have a foot in the world of saying, hey, there's something to this stuff in reality, so we should look at it. So how do you go far enough to make it entertaining, but not so far to kind of discredit the other side? You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. And that's an interesting question. You know, the short answer is that, well, it's fiction, and anything goes in fiction. You know, you can write about, you know, H.G. Wells, War of the Worlds, Martians landing and, you know, destroying New Jersey. As far as I know, New Jersey is still there, although it kind of looks destroyed. But, you know, but yeah, so where do you go with that? And I think what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to do in my fiction, I'm trying to make it plausible in the sense that when I write about ghosts or spirits or hauntings or anything in fiction, I try to use sort of the information that we have that is sort of known to ghost hunters that, yeah, this seems plausible. In our experience, when we go into a haunted location, we find that, you know, we hear footsteps or that we can record EVPs on a recorder or something like that. So I try to bring that in. I try not to go too far afield where I have, I don't know how to explain it, but let's say, you know, totally ridiculous example, but ghosts from Mars, let's say. You know, as far as I know, we don't have ghosts from Mars. I think they're all, you know, Earth-based entities. Mm-hmm. So that would be like taking, to my mind, that would be taking it too far, where somebody might say, well, you know, I can't buy into this. However, I'm not saying there's not a place for that type of fiction. You know, I gave the example of the War of the Worlds before, and almost any science fiction, you know, at least in the old days, before anybody knew about, you know, going to the moon or a rocket or anything like that. You know, we always had these visions of spaceships flying around. Some people think you're crazy. That's impossible. And yet, you know, it comes to fruition years later. So, you know, who knows? Maybe even some of this fiction might end up actually being reality as well. I don't know.
No, it is an interesting question, and it's a fascinating discussion as well. We're going to continue it with John Kachuba right after this on the Paranormal Podcast.
Can't get enough paranormal content? Sign up for monthly webinars, newsletters, and more shows. Join the Paranormal Plus Club at jimherald.net. Now back to the Paranormal Podcast.
Welcome back to the Paranormal Podcast. I'm Jim Harold. Our guest today is John Kachuba, and he's talking to us about his new book, out on ebook, Dark Entry. It's doing extremely well, shooting up the ebook charts and just in time for the Halloween season indeed. So let's talk a little bit about this book. Can you set the stage for us and give us some background on what we would expect if we would make a dark entry, as it were?
Sure. Well, Dark Entry is a story that is based on real history. And I grew up in Connecticut, and it's based on some historical facts in Connecticut. It takes place in a location called Dudleytown, which, you know, a lot of your listeners may have heard of Dudleytown, mm-hmm. which was an 18th century village up in northwest Connecticut that is today an abandoned site. And it's alleged to be haunted. And there are a lot of, you know, a lot of tales about Dudleytown that I don't even need to go in here. Anybody can just go on the internet and they'll find all kinds of information about that. What I did was I took the basic history, the historical facts of it being founded up there, and I wove in some of the legends that, or I should say the alleged hauntings and some of the tales that came from Dudleytown, and I created a new story based on what I thought might be the cause of it all and what might be going up there. And my story deals with some of the Native Americans that were in the area, and, you know, without giving it too much away, you know, basically I hung my story on the framework of all these tales that have already been around about Dudleytown. And in fact, I was up there myself a long time ago, maybe 25 years ago, and it's a very interesting place, and it is a historical location. It's on private property, which causes some problems if anybody was, you know, attempting to go up there, and they probably shouldn't because it is private property. I would just say, you know, read the book and get the story that way.
Now, do you believe that some geographic locations tend to be more haunted than others? And if so, do you have any theories on why that might be?
I think so. I think there are some locations that do have, you know, a predilection, let's say, to be haunted. And there are different theories. I've heard one theory about, depending upon certain mineral deposits in that area, like quartz or sometimes limestone, that in areas like that, they are better at, I don't know exactly the right way to say it, but if we believe that a haunting, let's say a residual haunting, something that happened years and years ago in that location and sort of replays itself, if we believe that that is the result of some kind of energy, you know, psychic energy being imprinted in that environment, then the theories are that some places that have some of these deposits are able to, I guess I'll say, hold that energy. I don't know how else to express it. Mm-hmm. Maybe make it manifest. You know, when you think about quartz being used, you know, quartz crystals being used in radios and all that kind of stuff, obviously there's some transmission properties and things like that with energy. So there's some theories that say areas like that hold that kind of energy, and so residual hauntings would be more frequent in those kinds of areas. And then I've also just heard too about, you probably heard this too, ley lines, you know, around the world. Right, and there's places where several ley lines may converge. I lived in Athens, Ohio for several years, and Athens, Ohio is a very haunted location, and part of the reason they think for that is that it seems that a lot of the ley lines do converge in that area. And so if that's the case, then again, there might be some higher frequency, let's say, of energy that would allow hauntings to be manifest or to replay or whatever. So there's a couple of theories, you know, about that. And, yeah, the bottom line is I do think there are areas like that that are more apt to record and to maintain, let's say, hauntings.
One thing that's always fascinated me when it comes to fiction is what people find frightening. What kind of go-to, I don't want to say devices, but what do you think people find the most frightening? For example, some people say they find something that's more intellectual, less blood and gore, more frightening than, you know, the kind of Saw movies and those kind of things. Mm-hmm. From your perspective, what scares people?
You know, I go that way. I go with more the unknown, the unseen, the unfelt, more psychological. One of my favorite movies of all time was, I think it's called The House on Haunted Hill. I'm trying to think.
Oh, yes, yes.
Movie. Yeah. And in this movie, you know, if you know, you never see a ghost, you never see a monster. All you see are the people in this house. You see their reactions. About the only thing you see, I remember one scene, there's a door that's a closed door. And it literally starts to, like, breathe almost, like it swells in and out and in and out, you know. That was about the only thing that you saw. All the rest was this psychological feeling of fear, of terror. One of my favorite books was Henry James's Turn of the Screw. Mm-hmm. And in that, you know, you have these two ghosts, Peter Quint, and Miss Jessel, who was a former governess, and they're both dead. And the character in this book, who is known as the governess, is seeing these two ghosts, and she's the only one that sees them. And all these other people don't see them, and she's thinking, surely they got to be seeing them. Look at their eyes, they're seeing them, but they just don't want to admit it. And so you have all this thing about, you know, what's real and what's not real. I think if you watch the movies, like you said, the Saw movies and everything, well, you know, once something jumps out at you once, it makes you go, you know, okay, done, that's it. When it jumps out at you the second time, the third time, now you're just starting to laugh. Like, yeah, okay, I know he's going to jump out again and, you know, cut my arm off. I mean, to me, it's gory, but it's not particularly frightening. I think what laughs are more the unknown, what we don't know, what we think is out there. Our mind can imagine much greater fear than any movie producer can show us.
Without giving anything away from your book, what were some of the true life? You talked about how you kind of hung the story on the skeleton of some things that happened in real life. What is some of the folklore tales that you had heard that inspired the story? Anything in particular that you could share?
Yeah, well, in short, the main tale alleges that the whole village was cursed as a result of the family that founded it, the Dudleys, going back to England, and apparently a curse was laid on them. This is the way the tale says. And as a result, over a century, a lot of the people that lived up there, this was a very remote little village up on top of a mountain, pretty isolated and everything else. People went insane. There were suicides. They would, you know, murders, disappearances into the woods, you know, and no one ever finding people again. Just a lot of sort of mayhem that incurred with all these people over this period of time, over about a century. You know, and proportionately, way out of proportion for the small number of people there. I mean, you would not expect all these things to have happened. And these are all alleged tales about that. And, you know, some are still debated. Some have been debunked, you know. But in any case, that was the whole idea about this, basically a curse being at work. And so what I did in my novel was I tried to locate that curse. I tried to say, okay, if there's a curse going on here, what is causing it? And that's where, for me, the ghosts enter into that.
I would be interested in your perspective on this. I like to ask this of people, and I get different answers. I definitely come down on one side or the other. You deal in the supernatural, and some things you're talking about seem obviously very frightening, and sometimes they could get into the idea of the notion of evil. Do you believe that evil exists as a thing or as an entity or as a spirit, or do you think that's misguided?
I don't think it's misguided in the sense that a lot of people believe that. And I'm not one to tell them that their beliefs are misguided. But for me personally, I don't hold to that. That takes sort of a theological bent to me, that there's, you know, evil and good, and there's a devil and there's angels and, you know, whatever. And I don't subscribe to any of that. What I believe is that whatever existence there is for us after this one, wherever we go as the person we were here. So if you were a wonderful, loving, kind, considerate, honest, truthful person here in this earthly plane, then whatever you go to, whatever the next stage is for us, you're going to be the same way. On the other hand, if you are a serial killer and a rapist and, you know, a mass murderer and, you know, whatever, you know, one of these Saddam Hussein, well, if that's how you were here, there's no reason to think you're going to change in whatever existence comes for you in the next life or whatever, however you want to phrase it. So you can be the same. So for me, what I say is that in that next realm, there are, I call it, you know, positive energies and negative energies. And, you know, some people call that negative energy evil. I don't. I just consider it to be negative energy, just like people here have negative energy. I don't think anybody's inherently evil or inherently good. I think we are what we are. I think we have, you know, we have both sides, and it's which one we choose to go with, you know, where we put our energy, where we put our resources, to good or to the other side.
That's an interesting perspective, and I've heard people with similar thoughts on it. Have you, since you're a certified ghost hunter, I'd be curious to see, have you been to any places that have truly frightened you? Other than just the intellectual stimulation of, wow, isn't this cool? Have you ever been afraid while you were out on a ghost hunt?
Yeah, there's been places that I have felt, insecure. You know, I'm not sure. I haven't been to a place yet where I ran out of it screaming, I'll never come back, you know. And I'm not saying that like I'm some big brave guy. It just hasn't happened. But I have certainly felt places where I have felt uneasy, and to the sense where I've said, okay, I don't like this environment, you know. There was one place in particular that I wrote about in my book, Ghost Hunters, which I can't name a location because it's privately owned, but it's an old abandoned farmhouse, actually in Ohio, in our state here, sort of around the Canton area. And I remember going into that place with some people, and you know, it was clear that there was some energy in there that you felt that was really, really, you know, again, sort of going to that negative energy thing. And I felt that. I felt like, you know, I don't want to be here. It wasn't like I saw anything or anything else, but it came across very clearly to me that this was not a good place to be. And in fact, we had a psychic with us on that particular time, and the psychic too was saying that, you know, she was not comfortable there, and she was getting all kinds of impressions that weren't good. So, yes, sure, definitely. And there's probably been a few others too, if I stop and think about it. That one just kind of, you know, sticks out of my mind for the most part.
I'd also be, when it comes to ghost hunting, I'd be interested in your perspective on two things, and what we'll start with the first. And maybe we've talked about this before, I'm not sure. But certainly the television programs that have come out in the last several years about the paranormal, including the ghost hunting programs, have certainly increased the visibility for people like me and for authors and for everybody. But some people feel that they're a double-edged sword, that they have some real negative connotations as well, because they may misrepresent what really happens in serious investigations. What are your thoughts on paranormal TV programs, the ghost hunting programs?
Well, I would agree with both. I think the TV programs over the last decade or so have been a real help to us, because they've shined a light on the paranormal. They've made talking about ghosts and going out and looking for ghosts or whatever more mainstream. You know, prior to the shows, I think a lot of people were probably reluctant to even talk about ghost experiences they may have had, thinking that people think they're crazy or something else. But with it being on television like this and becoming so popular, that stigma, I think, of saying, yeah, I had a ghost experience, you know, and I'll tell you about it, I think that's gone. So I think they've done a lot to make it more, to make the whole paranormal field more aware to the public. And I think that's been good. The other end of it is, yeah, it is a double-edged sword. It's entertainment. You know, we can never forget that television is entertainment. That's what it is. It's designed for ratings, to get people to watch it. So is some of it, you know, entertaining in that way? Yes, it is. And I'm not saying even that things are made up, but simply the editing process. You know, when these films are made, you might watch an hour film or an hour show, but there's probably, you know, 10 times as much film footage that was taken to create that show. Right? So, you know, however they edit and cut it, I mean, that alone is a process that says, well, we're not going to show this, but we're going to show this. So there's some subjectivity there, and it's done for the purposes of making it exciting and entertaining. And I don't have a problem with that. As long as people watch that program with that in mind, just like my books, you know, like I said, a dark entry is fiction. So when somebody reads that, You know, I want them to know clearly it's fiction. It's designed to entertain you. Not everything in that book actually happened. It's fiction. You know, it's a novel, which doesn't mean that there's not truths underlying it.
Right.
And that's the same thing with the TV shows. It's entertainment, but, you know, they're basic. Any one of the shows, most of the way they do their investigations, it's pretty much the way I see people doing investigations in the field. So I would say, yeah, basically that seems to be okay and everything. And some of the results they get are results that I've seen in the field. So, yeah, that's fine. There might be other things that I go, I'm not sure about that. But, you know.
Well, as a kind of continuation of that line of questioning, as it were, and you're certainly not in a stand here, but when you look at actually techniques, a lot has been made and probably largely due to the TV shows about the technology, EMF meters, portable digital recorders, video recorders, night vision recorders. What are your thoughts about the use of technology in the field on paranormal investigations?
Well, I think this is a real mixed bag. And every time I talk about this, I usually get in trouble with somebody.
Because, sorry to put you on the spot.
No, they don't like what I say. But I mean, what I believe is this. We don't have any scientific, and I mean truly scientific. You know, my wife has a PhD in toxicology. You know, she's a scientist. We don't have any scientific evidence of anything about ghosts. Nothing at all. Zero. We all go around saying that, well, they're creatures of energy, and you know, there's some science that says, well, everything has energy, but so we can at least maybe presume that. But does that mean that all the equipment we have, like an EMF meter or you know, whatever, are those really tools that tell us anything about ghosts, or are they just tools that say, well, yeah, there's a source of energy here? So I had mixed feelings about them. On the other hand, you know, I picked up EVPs myself with recorders that I know I've been in locations very remote, maybe by myself or with one other person or something, and I'll pick up something on a recorder that is very clearly a voice saying something, and I'll go, well, where did that come from? You know, I mean, I could be miles and miles and miles away from any radio tower or any, you know, police dispatch radio or anything like that, and yet I'll get something, and I go, well, I don't understand where that came from. So, I mean, I think technology has a place to maybe start gathering some of this data, but I'm not sure that we're really following a scientific method here, you know, and I think we're all just, you know, trying to collect what we can and make some sense of it. For me, I'm very low key. And when I go to a location, I take a camera and I take a recorder, and that's pretty much it. Half time I'm even taking an EMF meter or anything like that, you know. Now, I work mm-hmm. with groups that have all kinds of equipment, and it'll take us hours and hours just to set it up, and that's fine. But I go very low-key, and I also think that probably one of the best tools that we have is our own body. You know, what our mind tells us, what our gut tells us. I'm very cognizant of going into areas and feeling physically some sensations, you know, feeling sick to my stomach or headaches or something like that in an area, you know, a particular location where somebody might later on say, well, this is the area where, you know, they found the body hanging from the rafters or something. I go, oh, really?
Right.
You know? So that kind of thing. You know, and I also meditate every day. And I think that by learning how to meditate and learning how to practice like that, you know, you can reduce some of the conscious barriers that we all have, you know, in our mind, and just kind of let those fall away and make yourself a little bit more open for what might be in the environment. And this isn't magic. It's something we can all do. You know, we all have those tools. It takes a little training sometimes. We can all do it. So I always think, you know, that's probably the best tool is really what your own body tells you.
Well, it's it's something that we'll not solve in this discussion. We probably won't solve it in our lifetimes. But it is fascinating. I like a measured response to it, because sometimes what personally disturbs me about the TV shows, and I understand that it's, you know, produced for a mass market, and they have to make it look exciting, mm-hmm. but people running around screaming with you know, night vision cams. Sometimes I'm like, is this really the image we want to project? But it's a spectrum. It's a spectrum, and we have to understand there's a place for that. But then we hope people also want to delve a little deeper and do some serious investigation and some serious pondering about what's going on here.
That's right.
Well, John, tell folks where they can go on the internet to find your site. Obviously, sure. Where they can find this book, Dark Entry, and your other outstanding books, which are perfect for this time of year. Where can they go to find all that information?
Well, my website, my personal website, is www.johnkachuba.com, J-O-H-N-K-A-C-H-U-B-A.com. And you can order my books through that website, which will basically put you into Amazon anyway. My print books, my Ghost Hunting Ohio, Ghost Hunting Illinois, Ghost Hunting Ohio on the Road Again, and Ghost Hunters are in bookstores. They can be picked up, especially in October. They're going to be on the shelf again. And they can also be picked up through Amazon or whatever. The ebook, the electronic book, Dark Entry, is available only through Amazon. And I also have something called Ghost Stories, which is four short stories that are really kind of unique types of ghost stories, if I don't say so myself. And that's also on Amazon. They're both ebooks only. So those would have to be getting through Amazon.
Fantastic. Well, John Kachuba, happy Halloween to you. Thank you for joining us this week on the Paranormal Podcast, and look forward to continuing following everything you've got going on, and I'm sure there'll be some great new stuff coming down the pike in addition to everything you're doing now.
Well, thanks very much, Jim, and happy Halloween to you, too.
And thank you, listeners, and happy Halloween to all of you as well. We'll talk to you next time on the Paranormal Podcast. Bye-bye.
Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.